Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Kelly Jean Kelly, Brian Lynn, and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Kelly Jean Kelly.
The U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday approved President Donald Trump's travel ban that targets several Muslim-majority countries. Five of the nine judges, called justices, agreed that the president has authority to limit travel from foreign countries for national security reasons. Last September, Trump's government banned most citizens of Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen from traveling to the United States. Most North Koreans and some people linked to the Venezuelan government are also banned. A sixth Muslim-majority nation, Chad, also was included in the ban before the Trump administration removed it from the list. Tuesday's court decision means the ban will remain in effect. Trump could add more countries to the list. Opponents of the ban challenged the decision in court. They said the orders were illegal because they targeted Muslims. But a small majority of Supreme Court justices said the challengers did not show the ban violates either U.S. immigration law or the U.S. Constitution, which prohibits the government from favoring one religion over another. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote in the majority opinion statement that Trump's government had successfully demonstrated national security reasons for the ban. He added that the court would not comment on whether the policy was good. In a dissent statement, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote that a reasonable observer would consider the ban to be anti-Muslim, based on evidence in the case. She added that the five justices who approved the ban also turned a blind eye to the pain and suffering the proclamation inflicts upon countless families and individuals, many of whom are U.S. citizens. The Supreme Court's decision is a political victory for Trump. He has defended it as a key part of his immigration policy and part of his America First way of governing. Following the Supreme Court's decision, the president wrote on Twitter, in capital letters, "Supreme Court upholds Trump travel ban. Wow." I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Tens of thousands of people from Central and South America are spending part of their summer in Russia. They have gone to Moscow and 10 other Russian cities for the championship of international football, the FIFA 2018 World Cup. They have been cheering on football teams from across Latin America, from Mexico and Colombia to Peru and Argentina. Yet some of the many Europeans who are in Russia for the World Cup appear less excited. They said their friends at home told them they were foolish to go. The French news agency, AFP, says the differences among football fans at the biggest event in sports are a sign of Russia's slow move away from Europe since 2000. That is the year when Vladimir Putin became the country's president. Russia is now welcoming new allies that happen to love football, a sport known as soccer in the United States. Central and South American media rarely report about Russian wrongdoing or poisoning cases. Zbigniew Ivanovsky is with the Institute of Latin American Studies in Moscow. He noted that Russia's image is better in Latin America than it is in Europe and the U.S. Colombian football fan Mauricio Miranda praised what he saw in Moscow. He said, "We didn't expect it to be this beautiful, and the people are amazing." Jode Munter of Belgium, a public relations specialist, does not necessarily disagree. But he said his friends do. "I think Europeans are a bit afraid," he added. Europeans and Latin Americans are more likely to attend World Cup events held in their home countries because travel planning is easier and they know the area. But many Europeans made the long trip across the African continent in 2010 to witness the World Cup in South Africa. Information from FIFA, football's governing body, showed almost 50% more Britons bought tickets for the South Africa World Cup than the games in Russia. Australians were in third place in 2010, but are just ninth for ticket sales in Russia. Germany and England bought the fourth and fifth most World Cup tickets in 2010, and France was ninth. France dropped out of the top 10 in Russia, while Britain dropped down to last place. Germany stayed in fourth place. The United States has long led purchases among non-hosting countries because of its economy and large communities from Mexico and Central America. Without counting the U.S., Latin Americans bought two-thirds of the tickets sold to the top 10 countries. Many fans from Latin America are office workers in big cities. For example, Colombia's Mauricio Miranda is a city planner with a new job in Canada. Alessandro Grado is a former financial advisor with Mexico's Citibanamex. He now owns a plastics recycling business. He said, "Going to Russia is not expensive if you buy everything ahead of time." Yet not all fans have enough money to enjoy restaurants near the Kremlin. Sociologists who study soccer say this is where Latin American football federations come in. Ludovic Lesterlin is with the Université du Caen in Normandy, France. He said less wealthy fans in Europe get far less travel and housing assistance from government agencies. He adds that they are increasingly more likely to stay home and watch World Cup action on television. This means Europeans who attend World Cups are likely to be richer than the average football fan. But Latin American visitors are more likely to come from all economic classes and walks of life.
In June, the Oxford English Dictionary, or OED, added about 1,000 words and new definitions to its website. The changes are to help users understand a mix of terms, some dating back many centuries.
The additions include words such as Bren Cheese, Death Shieldy, and Hip Pop. The new entries are part of the company's update to OED.com, its searchable online dictionary for paid members. The OED makes changes to the website 4 times each year. But the latest print version has been in process since the year 2000 and may not be ready for 10 more years. That information comes from Catherine Connor Martin, who heads the company's dictionary operations in the United States. Usually, the OED watches usage of a word for at least 10 years before deciding whether to add a new entry, new definition, or word related to an existing entry, she said. This general rule, however, is sometimes not followed. That is what happened with tweet, a word that the OED added far before the 10-year mark.
Other times, the company adds words that are very old but were not included in the dictionary in the past. It's funny because we talk about new words, but many of the words we add are already obsolete. It's just that they were never in the dictionary before, Martin told the Associated Press. That is the reality, she said, of a historical dictionary trying to put more than 1,000 years of English into books that already have over 855,000 entries. So you get Bren Cheese, a rarely used term for when bread and cheese are eaten together. The word dates back to the year 1665. The word Death Shieldy is from Old English. It means someone who is guilty of a serious crime and condemned to death. The website defines the term hip-hop for music that combines parts of hip-hop and popular music. The OED discovered the term hip-hip-hop was used in a 1985 story from a Pennsylvania newspaper. It noted that the term hip-pop appeared in a 1991 U.S. newspaper report about the rap artist MC Hammer. The website has added several other terms related to modern culture. They include 3 popular terms: binge-watching, spoiler alert, and microaggression. Here are a few other new entries.
Imposter syndrome dates back to 1982 when Vogue magazine published a story about women who suffered from imposter phenomenon. Psychologists use this expression usually when talking to patients about their employment and the workplace. Imposter phenomenon means the inability to believe that one's success is justified or has been achieved as a result of one's own efforts or skills. The terms imposter syndrome and imposter phenomenon have the same meaning, with imposter syndrome currently the more popular of the two. The term dates to a psychotherapy story published in 1978. Changing ideas about human sexuality and relationships resulted in the words heteroromantic, biromantic, aromantic, and homoromantic, Martin noted. People have begun to self-identify as asexual, but they may still have romantic feelings short of actual sex, she said. Before, there was no word to describe this. A person who identifies as asexual does not desire sex, but can still want a romantic relationship that does not involve sex. But if they do not want sex or romance of any kind, they are both asexual and aromantic, Martin added.
The word homophily is similar in meaning to the expressions birds of a feather flock together and like attracts like. The OED defines homophily as a way of behaving in which people seek those they believe to be most like themselves. It shows society's growing resistance to having ties with people of dissimilar opinions. The dictionary found that homophily was first used in a 1953 article published in a sociological journal. The more general definition is similarities between individuals or groups. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Doug Johnson with Mario Ritter. We talk about the first 100 days of the administration of President Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt's inauguration speech in March of 1933 gave hope to millions of Americans. The new president promised to fight the Great Depression that was crushing the economy. His administration launched into action even before the inauguration ceremonies were finished. Back then, newly elected presidents were sworn into office in March instead of January. Roosevelt's aides began work even as he and his wife, Eleanor, watched the traditional inaugural parade. The lights of Washington's federal office buildings burned late that night. And not just on that night, but the next night, and the next night, too. The nation was in crisis. There was much work to do.
The first 3 months of Franklin Roosevelt's administration were an exciting time. Roosevelt got Congress to pass more pieces of important legislation during this short period than most presidents pass during their entire term. These 3 months are remembered today as the 100 days. Sunday, March 5th, was the day after the inauguration. Roosevelt asked Congress to begin a special meeting later that week, and he ordered all the nation's banks to close until the economy improved. Roosevelt also banned the export of gold. Congress met on Thursday, as Roosevelt had asked. It passed everything that the new president wanted. Both the House and Senate approved Roosevelt's strong new banking laws in less than 8 hours. Roosevelt signed the bills into law the same day.
The next day, Friday, Roosevelt called on Congress to cut federal spending. Once again, Congress met and approved Roosevelt's request immediately. 2 nights later, Roosevelt spoke to the nation in a radio speech. His warm, powerful voice traveled to millions of homes. He gave many listeners the hope that they could once again trust their banks and political leaders. On Monday, Roosevelt called on Congress to make it legal to sell beer and wine and to tax those sales. At that time, there was a national ban on alcohol. But once again, Congress agreed. Roosevelt's success in passing these laws excited the nation. People across the country watched in wonder as the new president fought and won battle after battle.
Washington was filled with activity. The air was full of energy, like a country sky during an electrical storm. People from around the country rushed to the Capitol to urge the administration to support their ideas. Bankers came by the thousands to win favorable legislation. Experts of all kinds offered new ideas on how to rescue the economy. Ambassadors came from Britain, France, Brazil, Chile, China, and many other countries. They came to speak with Roosevelt on economic and diplomatic issues. And members of Roosevelt's Democratic Party arrived by the thousands. They came to seek jobs in the new administration. Americans watched closely what was happening in Washington, and they liked what they saw. They had voted for action. Now, Roosevelt was giving them action.
One of the most important areas of action for the new administration was agriculture. American farmers had been hurt more than any other group by the economic depression. The average income of American farmers had dropped in 3 years from $162 a year to just $48. Farm prices had fallen 55%. The buying power of the average farmer had dropped by more than half. Many farmers could not even earn enough money to pay for their tools and seed. The main cause of the problems for farmers was that they were producing too much. There was too much grain, too much meat, too much cotton. As a result, prices stayed low. The situation was good for people in cities who bought farm products, but it was a disaster for the farmers who produced those products.
Franklin Roosevelt attacked the problem by limiting production. His administration put a new tax on grain products. The tax increased their price and reduced demand. The administration paid cotton farmers to destroy some of their crops. And it bought and killed 5 million pigs to reduce the amount of meat on the market. It was a strange situation. Some Americans had trouble understanding the economic reason why food had to be destroyed so people could have enough to eat. But more officials agreed that this was the only way to limit supply, raise prices, and save farmers. The plan worked. Production quickly fell. Hot weather and bad harvests in 1933 and 1934 reduced the amount of grain even more. As a result, prices rose. Farm income increased 50% in 4 years.
The administration also attacked the problem of falling industrial production. At the time of Roosevelt's inauguration, the production of American goods had fallen by more than half in just 4 years. Business owners reacted by cutting their costs. They lowered wages and reduced their number of workers. But these actions only reduced the number of people with enough money to buy goods. And so production went down further and further. Roosevelt created a National Recovery Administration that sought to gain the cooperation of businesses. Many business owners agreed to follow codes or rules, such as limiting the number of hours people could work. They also agreed to raise wages and stop hiring child labor. And they agreed to improve working conditions and to cooperate with labor unions. At the same time, Roosevelt created a Public Works Administration to provide jobs to unemployed workers. The federal government put people to work on building dams, bridges, water systems, and other major projects.
On monetary policy, Roosevelt and the Congress decided that the dollar should no longer be tied to the price of gold. Other action in Washington included a bill for homeowners that helped many Americans borrow money to save their homes. And a bank insurance bill guaranteed that Americans would not lose their savings. This insurance greatly increased public faith in the banks. Roosevelt and Congress created a Civilian Conservation Corps to put young men to work in rural areas to protect the nation's natural resources. These young men did things like plant trees and improve parks. They also worked with farmers to develop farming methods that help protect the soil against wind and rain.
One of Roosevelt's most creative projects was a plan to improve the area around the southern state of Tennessee. The Tennessee River Valley was a very poor area. Few farms had electricity. Forests were thin. Floods were common. Roosevelt and Congress decided to attack all of these problems with a single project. The new Tennessee Valley Authority built dams, cleared rivers, expanded forests, and provided electricity. It succeeded in helping farmers throughout the area, creating new life and hope.
The 100 days, the first 3 months of the Roosevelt administration, was a great success. One reporter for the New York Times observed that the change from President Herbert Hoover to Franklin Roosevelt was like a man moving from a slow horse to an airplane. Suddenly, the nation was moving again. There was action everywhere. Journalist Frederick Allen described the situation this way. The difference between Roosevelt's program and the Hoover program was sharp. Roosevelt's program was not a program of defense, but of attack. There was a new willingness to expand the limits of government. In most of the laws, there was a new push for the good of the common man. There was a new effort to build wealth from the bottom up rather than from the top down.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.